You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Mark Harris returns to the show this week. Mark Harris, who was a longtime columnist for Entertainment Weekly and whose work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and lots of other places, is the author of two essential film histories. The first of which was a New York Times notable book, is called Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood. In it, Mark Harris details the demise of the studio system in Hollywood, which had been in place since the 1920s, by describing the Academy Awards of 1968 for the films released in 1967. And those films included two landmark pictures, Mike Nichols' The Graduate and Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde. Those films heralded a new direction in Hollywood and reflected the change in American culture in the 1960s. Those movies were pitted against, among others, the anachronistic musical Dr. Doolittle. Mark Harris's second book, Five Came Back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, became a Netflix television series, and it tells the story of five filmmakers, John Ford, John Huston, George Stevens, William Wyler, and Frank Capra, and how World War II disrupted their film careers, sent them to document the war, and changed them and the films they came to make in post-war America, films like A Place in the Sun, Shane, The Searchers, The Best Years of Our Lives, and It's a Wonderful Life. Tonight, we turn our attention to the film that won the Academy Award for Best Picture of 1969, John Schlesinger's Midnight Cowboy. Despite being rated X, that film, which starred Dustin Hoffman and John Voight, Sylvia Miles, Brenda Vaccaro, and Bob Balaban, is now being released by Criterion, the company famous for its exquisite restorations of classic and notable films on DVD and Blu-ray. For this release, Criterion has wisely asked Mark Harris to contribute a brilliant essay, giving me the excuse to invite Mark Harris back to the show. Mark Harris, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me, Gary.
I'm excited to talk about Midnight Cowboy, but it's been a while since we talked. So I want to ask you about Five Came Back, the television series. What was that experience like?
Well, it was great. I had always had in my mind when I was writing the book Five Came Back that it would be great if there was a kind of video analog to it, because so many of the war movies I wrote about were obscure and really unfamiliar to people. And they were all available. They all exist. So I was incredibly happy to work with a very good team of people to give people a chance to hear a different version of that story told while seeing the movies that I had spent so much time researching and writing about.
And the series was very well received.
Yeah, we were just over the moon about how it was received. And the great thing is, I mean, we won an Emmy. That was exciting.
Yeah.
The great thing about Netflix, of course, is that it's just there. Like, if you missed it, you didn't miss it because it's you know, available to you at any time. So
things have changed since we were kids. I mean, if you missed it, you missed it in those days, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's another company in addition to Criterion that puts out, you know, like high class Blu-rays. A company you've probably heard of called Twilight Time.
Sure.
And they recently put out a restored, like, beautiful version of Dr. Doolittle. Did that surprise you?
Well, you know, one thing I've learned in you know, a decade plus now of doing these books is that every movie is somebody's favorite movie. Even Dr. Doolittle, you know, I think I've probably seen it more than anyone who wasn't involved in the making of it, and I don't have a lot of patience with it anymore, but I'm always surprised when people tell me, you know, I love it, it's one of my favorites, and even if it's not your favorite, it's definitely a kind of meaningful, at least to me, moment in film history that's worth marking. So I'm happy when I hear that any movie from the past is getting refurbished and polished up, and, you know, like, no matter what you think of Dr. Doolittle, it should be seen in its best, cleanest, you know, form.
in your movie, in your book, rather, Pictures in a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, you basically say that Dr. Doolittle was nominated for Best Picture because the producers got all the Academy Award voters drunk and gave them a big meal.
There's a lot of steak involved, and I think a degree of alcohol. And there was also, up until, Dr. Doolittle was 1967, but this was up until the early 70s, there was a degree of block voting where, you know, a studio could get all of its employees to get behind whatever it was pushing really hard, and often that would result in a nomination. The sort of most infamous one is The Towering Inferno in 1974, which was made by two studios. And after that, the Academy cracked down, and block voting became a thing of the past.
You'd think a movie with Paul Newman and Steve McQueen in it, that's going to be great. But it turns out to be The Towering Inferno.
Right, and it still gets the Best Picture nomination, so go figure.
They hadn't watched it. They just said, oh, it'll be great. Well, in your book that we just mentioned, Pictures of a Revolution, you really describe the kind of rise of the new Hollywood, as we call it, and that's the atmosphere in which Midnight Cowboy, the film you've just written about for this Criterion Blu-ray, was released. So talk a little bit about that, if you would. You know, what was the atmosphere that led to Midnight Cowboy?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, Midnight Cowboy was, if Pictures at a Revolution had gone on for about 100 more pages, I might have gotten to Midnight Cowboy. It was released in 1969, but it was conceived in 1965. And, you know, when I started Pictures at a Revolution, the question that I had in my mind, really the first question I had in my mind, was a question that had nothing to do with any of the movies I ended up writing about, and that was, how did we get from The Sound of Music in 1965 to Midnight Cowboy in 1969? And, you know, one really interesting thing about the movie is that the producer of the movie, Jerome Hellman, and the director, John Schlesinger, both sort of took a gamble on the idea that the length of time it would take them to get a workable script and a cast and studio financing for Midnight Cowboy would coincide with changes that they already saw coming in the movie business that would allow them to make the movie the way they wanted to make it by the time that they were ready to make it. They were basically placing a big bet that if they were in development for a few years, those few years would coincide with a gigantic loosening of standards, end of the production code, revolution in terms of the sex and violence and language that could be used in movies. And their gamble paid off. They were right.
It's interesting because when you think about those two movies, The Sound of Music and Midnight Cowboy, and you think about the current cinema, neither of those movies would be made today. Nobody would want to make either one of those movies.
You know, I suppose that's true, although The Sound of Music was certainly a big hit when they did it live on television a few years ago. And you know, you could say that The Sound of Music has its contemporary counterpart, I guess, in a movie like The Greatest Showman, which turned out to be an unexpectedly big hit for the same studio that made Sound of Music. And I guess the tradition of Midnight Cowboy kind of exists in indies more certainly than in studio movies. But the strange thing is, even in 1969, Midnight Cowboy was kind of halfway to an indie. It was made by United Artists, which was a studio and not a studio. I mean, it was a company that was sort of the Miramax of its day, in a way, a place where there was considerably more creative freedom and less interference than at the traditional studios.
In this last round of the Academy Awards, Get Out was kind of an exception. But generally, back in 1969, the movies that were nominated for Best Picture were also the movies that were financially successful as well as critically successful. Whereas today, the movies that are financially successful are never the movies that get nominated for Oscars.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that changes this year, because, or really next year, because there's already some talk that Black Panther, which of course was tremendously successful and is now domestically the third highest grossing movie in history, is going to be seriously campaigned for Oscars, and not just for things like visual effects, but for Best Director and Best Picture. And, you know, I think it has a real shot at getting into the race in a serious way and being part of the discussion, especially with more than five Best Picture nominees. So, you know, I don't think that the fact that high-grossing movies are generally not Best Picture nominees has to do with Academy snobbery about movies that make money. I think it has to do with the fact that the studios have abandoned their ambitions to make non-franchise movies that will appeal to a really large audience. They see their money in franchises, and franchises just don't tend to be recognized by the Academy because they're not really standalone experiences as movies. And that's why it's so exciting when a movie like Get Out, which really is its own thing and completely original, makes a lot of money. Or Black Panther, even, which is a franchise movie but stands so apart from, you know, the rest of what Marvel is doing. It really asserts itself as its own entity rather than as just Chapter 21 in the expanded Marvel Universe. So I think if a blockbuster comes along that's genuinely original, Academy voters would be happy to vote for it. They want to recognize movies that that people like. I think they were really excited to vote for Get Out last year.
Oh, it was a very good movie. But a lot of the movies, and maybe Black Panther's an exception, I think maybe Wonder Woman was an exception in that realm,
right,
too. But a lot of those movies appeal to, you know, 12-year-olds and not so much to an older audience.
Right. I mean, the Academy is, the votership is much older than the average moviegoer, which sort of makes sense because you're supposed to get in for achievement and it takes a while to achieve things. The membership has diversified in recent years in several different directions, maybe a little less in the direction of youth than in the direction of including more non-white voters and more women voters. But there are definitely, there's a bunch of new young members, so let's see what happens.
Well, Mark Harris, you were saying a minute ago that Midnight Cowboys producers were banking on the fall of the production code and the rise of something else, which turned out to be the ratings system. And how did that happen exactly?
Well, the production code fell bit by bit. In 1965 and 66, more and more movies were pushing against it, and particularly Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in 1966 and Blow Up, Antonioni's film at the beginning of 1967, were movies that the production code simply would not have passed in earlier years. And, you know, it eroded to the point where even the code itself realized that a restriction system, which is what the code was, you may do this, you may not do that, you can say this word, you can't say that word, a system like that would have to be replaced by a rating system. And so by the time, there was about, I think, an 18-month period when nothing was in place, when the code was no longer in place or being enforced, but when there was no rating system yet. But by the time Midnight Cowboy opened in 1969, we had the first iteration of the rating system, which was just three ratings, G, M, and X. G was for general audiences, M stood for mature, and I guess covered, you know, what would now be PG and PG-13. And X was not at that moment considered a designation akin to pornography. X meant adults only, and was kind of more like R and X now.
Well, or NC-17 as they call it now, right?
Right, and Midnight Cowboy itself was re-rated R just a couple of years after it opened, without any cuts. So the X that it got in 1969 would be the equivalent of an R now, but it would still be an R-rated movie.
Well, I think one of the differences, or it might be PG-13 now, but one of the differences in the rating system then and now, I think, is that when you say now that a movie has mature themes, what you usually mean is it has immature themes.
Right.
Whereas Midnight Cowboy, although it was rated X before X was, as you said, designated as a porn, triple X, whatever, what it meant was it had adult subject matter that adults would be interested in and that kids simply wouldn't be interested in because they wouldn't understand the movie.
Yes, I think that's right. Midnight Cowboy is a mature movie. It's a very sad movie. It's a movie about, in a way, the loss of youth. It's about these two men who had dreams of being people who are would be very different than the people they turned out to be, and at fairly young ages, are living a completely different and much grimmer reality. And that's a hard thing, I think, for young people to immediately get their heads around. I think when I've talked to younger audiences about Midnight Cowboy, which of course they view from a considerable distance of history because it was filmed long before they were born, and in some cases before their parents were born, I think they're surprised by how raw and how sad and how grim it is, rather than by how explicit sexually it is, because it's really not particularly.
There's just like fleeting nudity that I remember in it.
Right. Fleeting is exactly the right word. I mean, there's a little bit, but not a lot.
Hi, I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with author Mark Harris. His books include Pictures at a Revolution, Five Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, and Five Came Back, The Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, which was also made into a Netflix television series. And tonight we're talking about an essay he wrote for the Criterion re-release of the movie Midnight Cowboy. Mark Harris, in the essay you wrote for the Criterion release of Midnight Cowboy, you quote Vincent Canby, I think it is, who said that it was not a film that would last, although for audiences today, it not only stands up as a dramatic piece, but is also a document of a New York that is long gone.
Yes, it was Vincent Canby who said it, and he liked the movie, and he basically said, if you want to know what 42nd Street is like right now, if you want to understand this moment in New York City history, you're not going to get a more vivid, realistic look at it than this, and you're never going to walk down 42nd Street the same way again after you see this movie. But he said it's not a movie for the ages, and you know, it's interesting to me, this is a gambit that movie critics try over and over again, and it's the worst. I think movie critics have a worse track record at playing the game of is it timeless or is it of the moment. It's like your batting average on that is going to be terrible. You know, you could list all the movies that were called timeless the minute they opened that are long forgotten, and all the movies that people said were really fun or kind of interesting or different but weren't going to last and nobody was going to look at down the road that we still talk about. And Midnight Cowboy, of course, it's absolutely still relevant, but it's relevant because it actually wasn't trying to be timeless. Its goal was to show something very real of that moment in time and of these characters. And that is actually maybe a better way to endure than by straining for timelessness.
In your other book that everybody left, so five came back, A Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, Mark Harris. You talk about the 1940s, and 1941 was a year in which there were many, many great films, and they were all nominated for Best Picture. And the one that won, How Green Was My Valley, it's a lovely film, but that was the year of Citizen Kane and
right.
And the Maltese Falcon. So many movies that truly were timeless. I know,
it's a shame because, you know, How Green Was My Valley is a really good movie. And it's sort of sad that in the history of the Academy Awards, it's always going to be known as the movie that beat Citizen Kane. Like, it's always going to be on the sort of wrong end of an injustice story. So sometimes winning Best Picture is the worst thing that can happen to the reputation of a movie, because, of course, we should just enjoy How Green Was My Valley on its merits and as an important film in the career of John Ford, rather than view it as a movie that did something to a more deserving movie, which, of course, you know, it didn't. It had nothing to do with whether it won or lost.
It is interesting, though. I mean, there are some movies that have won Best Picture that, you know, now you scratch your head about, like, not just The Greatest Show on Earth, maybe, but more recently, Crash, or... I mean, those were good movies, but...
You know, there are a ton of movies that didn't win Best Picture where people see the movie and love it and look back and think, how could that not have won? You know, in the long run, and even increasingly in the short run, if this is kind of a contest about reputation, the movie will always beat the award. You know, nobody ever says, oh, that lost Best Picture, it can't be very good, or I really liked that movie, but then I looked it up and saw it didn't win anything, so I guess I don't like it anymore. I mean,
well, Midnight Cowboy won the Academy Award for Best Picture. I think it was a shock. I remember it being a shock when it won, because it had been rated X.
I think so, and it violates what we now think of as an Academy standard, which is that the most out there, the most acclaimed, the edgiest movie can get nominated but will never win. And the films that were nominated in 1969 were much more benign for the most part than Midnight Cowboy. You know, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I think Hello, Dolly was nominated. So it didn't look like the Academy was going to go that hard in the direction of a movie that was that sharp and clean a break with everything that it had always rewarded. And in fact, you know, John Boyd and Dustin Hoffman were both nominated for Best Actor that year, and they lost to John Wayne for True Grit. So it looked maybe as if the Academy was going to react against Midnight Cowboy, but then Schlesinger won and the film won.
I believe Richard Burton also had a nomination that year in Best.
Yeah, was that the year of Anne of a Thousand Days?
Yeah. No, it was like, oh, there's no way John Wayne is going to win.
Right. I mean,
looking back on True Grit, I think it's a better movie than I thought it was in 1969. But I still think that if you were going to give an award to John Wayne late in his career, The Shootist would have been a much better picture to give it to him for.
Right. And, I mean, I don't think there's ever in Academy history been anything quite like John Wayne winning Best Actor for True Grit and then Midnight Cowboy, a movie that actually references John Wayne as this kind of empty promise of masculinity that doesn't conform to reality, wins Best Picture. I mean, that's a sort of amazing, you know, whenever people talk about the Academy as monolithic, I always want to remind them that those two things happened in the same year, in the same moment. The split could not be clearer.
Does history record whether or not John Wayne ever saw Midnight Cowboy?
You know, when I was doing the essay, I did a little bit of poking around, and I didn't find anything about it. But I'm sure if people go through the John Wayne biographies, which are numerous, there must be something about that, because it's too irresistible a question for someone not to have chased.
Well, Midnight Cowboy has, as you said, those two great performance. It's got many great performances from a wide variety of performers, young performers like Balaban and older performers like Sylvia Miles. I mean, there's all kinds of great people in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
But talk a little bit about how it was cast and how Dustin Hoffman and John Voight became involved.
Well, I believe that Dustin Hoffman was cast first. And he was sort of a sharp break from the character of Ratso Rizzo as described in James Leo Herlihy's novel. Ratso is described almost as, I mean, he is a runt. That keeps coming up. He's very small, but he's blonde and almost angelic. And Hoffman was actually, you know, obviously dark and scraggly and really scruffed himself up. Hoffman was at a real kind of moment of stardom after The Graduate in 1967. He was a big get for this project. He was a good get. And he was actually instrumental in, as they looked at different actors for Joe Buck, he made a very strong case for John Voight, who was not a particularly well-known actor at that time, but who Hoffman felt could really hold his own on screen. And I think Hoffman said something like, you know, in all the other screen tests we've done, I'm looking at me when I watch the screen test. When I worked with John, I'm looking at him. So in a way, it's a very generous and brave thing for an actor to do, to say, this guy could give me a run for my money, and I think you should cast him. And, of course, I think Hoffman and I think Schlesinger, too, probably responded really well to the great physical contrast. I mean, Hoffman is short, dark, unshaven, hangdog, and John Voight, at that time, you know, tall, blonde, baby-faced, apple-cheeked, very innocent-looking. They, you know, when you close your eyes and think of Midnight Cowboy, probably the first visual image that comes to mind is of the two of them walking down the street together. You know, Voight tall and in his incredibly silly hat and fringe jacket, and Hoffman very short and shuffling along and dragging his foot. And you know, that pairing, the way they look together on screen is so arresting. I think it was just a great call to cast Voight.
And that brings us to this question that you discuss in the essay, and that people have been discussing since the film was made, what is the nature of their relationship, and in that way, what is the film's place in the history of gay cinema?
Right. It's a very, you know, 50 years later, we're still arguing whether Midnight Cowboy should be called gay cinema at all, because it is a love story between two men, each of whom insists absolutely that he is not gay, and yet what their sexuality is left kind of intriguingly unresolved in the movie, less resolved than it is in the novel, where you learn that Joe has had sex before ever arriving in New York with both men and women. You know, it's at a pivotal moment in the movie, Ratso kind of accuses Joe of not being gay, but seeming gay, of being attracted to things that are gay, and Joe accuses Ratso of being a virgin, and both of the accusations in the scene sting. You can see that they hit home in these really kind of vulnerable places. So we don't really know. I mean, Joe is almost dangerously unformed. He in many ways seems like not an adult yet, although he is. And at the very, very end of the movie, he's just, I think, figuring out who he wants to be, although maybe too late. And Ratso, we're given very, very little backstory about him. But really what we see in Midnight Cowboy, and I think this is why we come back to it so many decades later and are still moved by it, is it's a story of two men who are aching for human connection, that they are so bereft of it that, you know, they turn to each other because they're just desperate to be treated halfway decently by anyone. And that's really moving. But whether it fits into a canon of gay cinema or queer cinema, it's really, you know, it's tough, and it's complicated by the fact that Schlesinger was a gay director at a time when there weren't nearly as many as there are now. But Schlesinger himself says that he feels his coming out movie was Sunday Bloody Sunday, the movie he made 2 years after Midnight Cowboy, not Midnight Cowboy. And I think if we were to, I mean, Schlesinger passed away some time ago, but I think he would probably have said flatly that Midnight Cowboy is not a gay movie.
Or it was maybe too early for a gay movie.
Right. I mean, some of Joe's clients are clearly gay. You know, Bob Balaban, this young boy who's just desperate to have sex with him, and some of the older, more lecherous men he encounters. But Joe, you know, the only sex we have him see is in the movie is transactional, and there are flashbacks to some sort of brutalization or humiliation of him that grew out of his encounter with his sexual encounter with a young woman, but we don't really know who he's attracted to, and it's kind of effective for the movie that that's left unresolved.
Hi, I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with author Mark Harris. His books include Pictures at a Revolution, 5 Movies and the Birth of the New Hollywood, and 5 Came Back, The Story of Hollywood and the Second World War, which was also made into a Netflix television series. And tonight we're talking about an essay he wrote for the Criterion re-release of the movie Midnight Cowboy. You mention in your notes that Midnight Cowboy is in some ways like a pastiche of 1960s film techniques.
Yeah, that's largely, I think, due to Schlesinger wanting to try a lot of new stuff and his cinematographer, Adam Hollander. Schlesinger gives himself opportunities to go a little wild in the movie. There's an Andy Warhol party that lets him use kind of strobe effects and wild angles. He alternates between color and black and white in one sequence. He overexposes the film for effect in some places. It's really a little bit, I mean, that stuff in some ways is the most dated material in the movie. Like when Ratso and Joe go to this wild party, this underground party, and you see Viva and Ultraviolet and other members of the sort of Warhol extended universe, that suddenly you're very, very hard situated in 1969. You know, I like that. I like that aspect of the movie because even though it's a little awkward and not nearly as kind of daring or exciting now as it must have seemed then, it reminds you that the movie came out of a certain place and time and sensibility, and it also reminds you that Schlesinger, who was not American, he was British, was kind of agog in New York and just wanted to film, you know, every nighttime grimy corner of it that he could.
Like that scene where the woman has the little toy mouse that she's running up and down her boy's hand.
Right. I mean, I think everything, I feel like everything Schlesinger saw delighted him, and everything he saw appalled him, and he was judgmental about all of it. And you can feel that judgment sometimes in his movies. I mean, I think at his worst, his camera can be cruel, but at his best, it's not cruel. It's just kind of unsparing. It's like an eye that doesn't close. It just keeps looking and looking and forces you to look too.
It's a very powerful film, I think, and it's not unlike other films of that era in which you were referring to the various techniques. I mean, even Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, in the middle of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, it suddenly becomes 1969 because they play a song, Raindrops Keep Falling My Head, and they have a montage of scenes, and it suddenly looks like 1969 in the middle of the movie. And there's slow-mo, they have to have a slow-mo scene, you know.
Right, but I mean, this is just an affliction, I guess, of any creative art, which is that you never know at the moment you're doing it the thing that you're doing that will date you. You know, I see all these. I've been watching a lot of like 1980s thrillers lately, and I sort of giggle every time this really intense synth soundtrack comes on, and. And I remember seeing those movies in the 1980s and feeling, you know, as a very young moviegoer, like, there's never going to be anything more modern than this kind of music. You know, you always kid yourself that you've kind of, culture has reached an endpoint, and whatever you're doing that's right now is just the final greatest expression of what movies or music should be. And then that is often the thing where even 5 years later you're like, oh, why did I do that?
But the new Hollywood really was famous for that. I mean, there's a lot of films like Midnight Cowboy or Five Easy Pieces or Blow Up, you mentioned, that, you know, it would be very unlikely that any studio would want to make a movie like that now or that any audience would be drawn to see a movie like that, even though those are great movies.
I mean, I think there was a feeling on the part of the studios of, like, let's try this. It can't hurt. And there was a feeling on the part of audiences that if you wanted to see something that was really pushing the envelope, that was, if you wanted to go someplace and see a piece of culture that would show you something that you'd never seen before, you had to go to the movies, because certainly you weren't going to see it on TV. And that's one thing that's really changed, of course, so much, is that as restrictions on TV were lifted and as they've gotten more and more experimental in terms of form and content and willing to kind of take chances, there's not a sense anymore that if you want to see something really daring, you have to go to the movies. It's more a sense that if you want to see something really huge, you have to go to the movies. Movies can still sell themselves based on size, just not on shock value.
Well, the line that separated movies from television was commercials, and that line doesn't exist anymore.
Right. Right, exactly. I mean, commercials and content, you know, that you would never, if you loved movies in the 1960s or 70s, you would never wait and say, oh, I'll just see it when it's on television, because
right.
You knew that you were going to see something that was interrupted and edited.
And truncated, yeah. And not only that, but the size of the screen would be changed and all those other things.
Right.
It's a fascinating movie, and I'm anxious to see. I haven't had a chance yet to see the Criterion Blu-ray. What have they done to the film that would be different from the previously released versions of it?
You know, I have to tell you, I have not seen the Criterion Blu-ray either. When we write these essays, the film itself is often still in the process of being worked on. So
we don't know.
so I don't really know. I mean, I know that you know, the obviously with Criterion, it's going to be pristine. The scratches and the faded color, you know, have been corrected. They're trying to restore it to as much as what it was originally, the best version of what it was originally, as they feel is possible. What you're not going to see is new scenes added into the movie. This isn't an extended cut or a director's cut. I think Schlesinger felt quite clearly that the movie was the director's cut of the movie. So what you will see is Midnight Cowboy, as it was seen in 1969, I imagine in a great looking version with all of the bells and whistles and extras and interesting interviews and background stories that distinguish Criterion.
Well, Mark Harris, now that you've mentioned you've been watching a lot of 80s movies, is that what you're going to write about next? What's coming next?
Well, only coincidentally, because my next book is going to be a biography of Mike Nichols. So that will take me from the 30s through the early 2010s. And for Mike Nichols, the 80s meant Silkwood and Working Girl and Heartburn and a bunch of really interesting theater. So that's where I am right now in the research that I'm doing. But this book is going to be a little bit of a departure because I'm not going to be following several projects over a period of 5 or 6 years. I'm going to be following one man for a really fascinating long life and career.
And what a great career it was, and what great films he made. And I want to ask you this question about Mike Nichols, and then we'll continue this when your book comes out. Would you call Mike Nichols an auteur or a journeyman film director?
I think that is a really interesting question, one that I hope to explore in the book. I think if you look at his career, to me, he's someone who came out of the gate in a way as an auteur with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate, and then perhaps decided that the things that interested him and impassioned him would not add up to a career that would necessarily be characterized later as auteurist, and that it didn't matter, that he did what he wanted to do, regardless of whether it was going to add up to a sort of cohesive Bergman-esque body of work or not. I think he was an auteur ultimately, in that there are hallmarks that distinguish his work and that to me carry over from movie to movie, but I don't think that most people would necessarily consider him an auteur, and I also don't think I don't think that auteurs are necessarily better than directors. You know, I think what matters is the movies you leave behind.
And he left so many great movies behind, and all the way through his whole career. One of his neglected classics is Regarding Henry. I think it's one of the most marvelous films ever.
Yeah, it's very interesting to revisit these movies. He didn't make a ton of them. He only made like 17 or 18 films, and of course, at the same time, I'm tracing his incredibly active stage career, which won him 7 or 8 Tonys, and I think, you know...
He directed Barefoot in the Park, didn't he?
He won for Barefoot in the Park, and he won his last directing Tony 50 or 51 years later for a revival of Death of a Salesman. And I don't think that any stage director is going to equal that 50-year centrality, at least not for a very, very long time.
Well, I'm looking forward to that book. That's going to be great.
Thanks.
I'm excited to watch Midnight Cowboy again, coming soon from Criterion, with a marvelous essay that everyone will enjoy reading after they watch the movie, from my guest, Mark Harris. Mark Harris, thank you so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks again. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I want to thank my guest, Mark Harris. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson, and I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. Check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. We'll see you next time.